This is Barry Tyker of the UW Oral History Project. Today is October 1st, 1998. I'm in the office of Dr. Joshua Lederberg in Founders Hall at Rockefeller University in New York City, and we're having our third interview session. Let's begin today by talking about a little bit about Carl Sagan and your relationship to him in Madison.
I think I met Carl. I certainly met him through Lynn. I'm not certain whether they were married. Lynn Sagan. She was a graduate student in the Department of Zoology. She was working with Walter Plaut doing her dissertation on mitochondria, and later on developed her career around the rather striking idea that mitochondria might be derived from symbiotic bacteria. I met Carl socially on some occasion, probably in 1957, I would guess. When the time came that I was trying to put together a committee to start exploring the issues of planetary quarantine and the establishment of a biological basis for investigations using spacecraft, it occurred to me that there were hardly any astronomers who could speak biology as well, but that Carl, despite his youth, was going to be one of them. Well, I wasn't going to hold his youth against him. So I essentially introduced him to NASA by this route. He was doing his doctoral work with Kuiper, K-U-I-P-E-R, at the University of Chicago. This was located at the observatory in Lake Geneva. So I think they lived in Madison and he commuted to Lake Geneva. At least that was certainly true for part of his career there. And he was a very bright, articulate, eager, energetic person, very capable of both very imaginative and very critical judgments, and was enormous help in getting our committee underway and providing authentic astronomical verisimilitude to the other kinds of things that we were arguing about. There weren't that many astronomers interested in planetary astronomy in those days, so that was really a lucky break. Well, astronomers are interested in big things. I mean, planets aren't all that important, after all, in the cosmic view and the development of stars and galaxies and new strange objects that are millions of light years away. It continues to be the major preoccupation of astronomers and astrophysics. Also, there wasn't that much information available about planets. It seems anomalous, but we know much more about the composition of distant stars, and at least until we began space travel, than we did about the planets, because the stars were heated up to a temperature that they emitted characteristic spectra. They were also at a temperature that you could be quite sure they had very little by way of molecular structure that you'd need to worry about. So we knew a lot about the composition of stars, just as we knew a lot about the composition of the sun, and very little about any of the planets until there was an opportunity to actually land there and sample them. So planetary astronomy is really a rather recent redevelopment within that field, not to mention its connections with biology.
Now, you both ended up out west, wasn't he out west as well?
As it turned out, I forgot. After Carl got his doctoral degree, he had some arrangement. I'm not exactly sure which was which. Partly in my department, partly at Berkeley, and partly at the Ames Research Labs of NASA. I'd have to go back to the chronology to unscramble it. But I saw a good deal of him again at Stanford after I moved there in February 1959. But he was very actively engaged. During all of 1958, I was quite busy with the Academy-based committees on space travel, and he played a very active role in all of them.
Let's switch just for a moment to the race to discover the structure of DNA. We found out it was a race after the publication of the double helix. Francis Crick and James Watson and Linus Pauling was trying to make the discovery at the same time. Watson refers to you in the book, The Double Helix. He did some bacterial research. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I met Jim while I was at Madison. he would occasionally attend meetings of the so-called Phage, Midwest Phage Group that Leo Szilard had organized. He had a small grant from the Rockefeller Foundation, which had two purposes. One was the Leo Szilard's own education, and the other a means of getting together of people at the cutting edge of this kind of work, who in those days were mostly in the Midwest. We had Luria and Sonneborn, Spiegelman, the group in Madison. We had Novick and Szilard in Chicago. I think at one point there was Benzer at Purdue. So various members of this group would meet from time to time in Chicago, perhaps in Madison, perhaps in Bloomington or Urbana. Jim showed up at a couple of those as one of Luria's graduate students, a very lanky fellow then, even more than now. He had just changed his interest, I think, as an undergraduate at the University of Chicago, if I'm not mistaken. He was mostly interested in birds and was an apt bird watcher, but his work with Luria altered his direction to where it was canonical phage work. Then, after he completed his degree, he tied up at some point with Bill Hayes and did a paper on mapping of genes in E. coli. Since I reported this at the Cold Spring Harbor Symposium in 1951, there was really quite a crisis in trying to understand the chromosome structure in E. coli. There was no question about linkage. Up to a certain point, you could draw a linear map. And then it collapsed using the methods of analysis we then had available. The only way that I could formally represent the data was for the map to branch, because we had two or three different things that appeared to be linked to some common point but were not closely linked to one another, and they just didn't fit linear mapping at all. Some people thought I was proposing a branch chromosome. That was not right at all, and I said so in the caption that was the way of expressing the anomaly, was to say that if you take the mapping literally, this is the drawing that you had come out with, and we just didn't know what that structure was going to be. So Jim and Hayes did their own analysis, some new data, not much, mostly using existing data, and came out with an alternative theory that there were three separate chromosomes in E. coli. I did not think that was justified. I had data that suggested that there was linkage between markers that they had put on separate chromosomes, even if I couldn't put them on a linear map. Now, that was a passing item. That was moderately soon superseded by the work of Jacob and Volman, showing that what was wrong was not the question of linearity in the chromosome, but the fact that you were not getting the entire genome into a fusion cell all in one gulp, and different fragments of varying size were entering, and that's what complicated the linkage analysis. I had no idea he was going to work on the structure of DNA. In fact, I don't think he had any idea that he was going to do that. His original fellowship abroad was to work with Herman Kalkar in Copenhagen. But as Jim has described, Herman was preoccupied with his courtship of Barbara Wright, and I'm not sure that there wasn't also an element of some disappointment on Jim's part about how that fared, but at any rate, he decided, as he's described in his book, to move to Cambridge, and the rest, as you know, is history.
The rest is history, it certainly is.
As far as the chemistry of DNA, the previous node of studies on that point does in fact appear in the 1951 Cold Spring Harbor Symposium, I've forgotten exactly who was in attendance, but there are extensive allusions to the work of Gulland, of Chargaff, and of others, but they were not providing, none of those people were doing X-ray structure as far as I can recall. They were doing analytical work to try to get a little more detail on the precise base composition, and especially from the work of Chargaff, it eventually became evident that there was not an exact 1:1:1 ratio of the four nucleotides, and that deviations from that meant that there was a rather more complex structure than the tetranucleotide. that Phoebus Levine had been arguing for, and then still a lot of scrambling, which was only straightened out after the x-ray work, and Crick and Watson published that structure in 1953. So that was a very hot 2 years, but I was not connected with Jim during the time he was abroad, and I don't recall when I heard of the structure. I think there was some inkling of it within some days of the time that it was published in Nature. I don't think there was much time during which the information was abroad that it was not very rapidly sent for publication.
Were you surprised when you heard that Crick and Watson had done it first?
No, I didn't really know who else was in it. I didn't have the background of, when you say of who was doing it first, I was not aware of the race at the time that came out with Jim's book. Was interested in the structure. I think it's uncanny how thoroughly and how profoundly Watson and Crick not only did the structure, I think in a certain sense anyone could have done that, given a little more time, a little more data, but how they understood how to couple their physical structure that they elucidated with what this meant for the biological mechanism of replication. And that's the really, really brilliant part of their paper, is a totally accurate forecast of how complementarity of DNA sequences was going to work out for the mechanism of information transfer, of replication, and so on. The only thing they got wrong, and one that Arthur Kornberg would complain about, was that they thought that somehow DNA all by itself would have this self-replicating capability. And of course, it was Kornberg's lot to have the inspiration to study the enzymatic machinery by which DNA was replicated. There's no mention of such enzymatic machinery in the Watson-Crick paper. But in a way, maybe the nucleotide chemists have had the last laugh, because it now turns out that if not DNA, RNA has enzymatic activity as well as its informational one. This has not been demonstrated for DNA, but it was not such a bizarre thought after all to think that it might have both catalytic activity and be the information store. As I said, it's not been, that has not been substantiated, or I should say not substantiated yet for DNA, but it has for RNA.
Getting back to your work in Madison, the early 1950s was an interesting time in the history of computers on campus. When did you start working with computers, and how did that develop over your years at Madison? And were you aware of, and did you use the numerical analysis lab?
Well, I had first become interested in computers on my first exposure to them, which was in 1941, when there was a card sequence controlled calculator installed in the American Institute Science Laboratory.
Oh, really?
At 310 Fifth Avenue in the shadow of the Empire State Building. This laboratory was the forerunner of what later became the Westinghouse Science Talent Search. But in 41, in fact, it was a facility, a program that provided facilities to high school students who wanted to do bona fide research at a time when the high school labs were even less equipped to do that than at the present time. So by examination, I in effect won, you might even call it a scholarship, to be able to work at this laboratory. And while my own project was in cytochemistry, the chemical identification of cellular constituents by specific staining reactions under the microscope, there were some others there who were starting to fiddle with these machines. Now, these were not very elaborate computers. They were relay-driven. They involved punch cards. Basically, the only memory they had were the intermediate cards. So if you wanted to calculate a square root, you could put in a number, have it programmed to do that. It would probably burn up several dozen cards with the intermediate results before it finally spewed out the final answer.
Amazing.
But it was the first robot I'd ever seen. You might say the first intellectual robot. It was not that far from Babbage's calculating engine in many, many ways. And his was a mechanical one, and here was indeed an electromechanical one with relays playing the role. So I was quite intrigued by its analogy to living organisms, and I, from that moment, followed computers, mostly from afar and from the press. Well, when I came to Wisconsin, I found there was a numerical analysis laboratory. Fred Gruneberger was in charge of the computers of that time. And I wanted to learn a little. I didn't have any immediate use. I wasn't doing large-scale statistics, but I just thought I should familiarize myself with robots as of that stage of their development. So I took
Was that in right around the time you came, about 1946?
No, it was a little earlier. It was 52.
52, okay.
Yeah.
Great. Go ahead.
So I took Fred Gruneberger's course, and there I learned about plugboard programming, the next stage in their development. I couldn't think of anything that I needed them for, but I was really quite intrigued by here were complex systems, could be programmed. There was a conceptual framework of regulation, control, that I was sure would end up being very important, but I had to put it aside. I wasn't doing the kind of statistical work that Jim Crow was doing, for example, in population studies. And they were pretty rigid machines. We did not yet have compilers, programming languages, and so on and so forth. So it wasn't until I got to Stanford about 10 years a few years after I was there, 10 years after the Gruneberg course, that I took a Fortran course, and at that stage computers had reached the point where there's really a lot you could do with them, but that's another story.
Okay, well, we won't go into that one today.
It was not my motive in going to Stanford. I think Wisconsin would have been almost equally advanced in that regard, but it was something I found there when I got there.
Yeah, it was really starting to develop right about mm-hmm. that time. Mm-hmm. Let's leave research, excuse me, and go to your teaching at the UW. You were hired primarily to do research, but you also had some course responsibilities. Could you talk about those, please?
Well, it was expected of me, and I would have been disappointed if it weren't, that I give a course on the genetics of microorganisms, mm-hmm. and may well have been, if not the first, one of the very early courses of that kind in the country. So this was cross-listed with microbiology. It was an advanced undergraduate course would be the level at which was offered. I assumed students would already have had, well, not necessarily, because there were microbiology students who might not already have had other genetics courses. So it just started from the ground up. I put together, as a textbook, I use a compilation of papers of recent work, reprinted and bound into a red-covered book that the University of Wisconsin Press put together, and that itself was an innovation about using that kind of material for course purposes. But in a rapidly developing field, there really wasn't time to wait for somebody to write a textbook. There were papers coming out every month. It was hard to keep up even just using the reprints. I think that was quite successful. I think the Red Book was used elsewhere and was then emulated by a number of other comparable collections as time went on. So I don't know what more to say. We covered the basic topics of clones, mutation, the Luria-Delbruck distribution, how you analyze, how you measure mutation rates, mutagenesis, and then interclonal phenomena of recombination, transformation, transduction. And one could, until the mid-50s, one could in one course teach everything that had been published in the field.
Wow. Whoa, boy.
You know, now 1 week would be more than enough to exhaust you.
Yeah. I seem to have read somewhere that you also did a lot of guest lecturing on other departments in the campus or other courses in the genetics.
Yes, well, I'm sure I taught in the standard genetics course. I probably gave one lecture a year in that, and from time to time in other courses, probably mostly in microbiology. Unfortunately, I don't have a good diary of those days, and it's been hard for me to reconstruct what my day-to-day activities were.
You said you had a Red Book that you put together. Do you have a copy of that yet?
If you want to hang on, I can get it for you. Okay. Of course, there have been anthologies of all kinds that have been used for various purposes, but I'm not aware of anything prior to this, which was precisely a collected reprints in a scientific field as a teaching tool. So I'd be curious if others would chip in and tell me about that. I didn't have any model in front of me, but it was a very, very effective and worthwhile activity. But it also gave me experience in writing around to publishers for permission and all that kind
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah, that's good skill to have.
But I had total cooperation at that point.
I have the book in my hand now, and this looks like something that could be on sale at the university bookstore today.
Well, Kinko's does this to order.
Traditionally, yeah, to order. They'll just put one together for you. It's very interesting. I'll have to see if we can find scratch one up at UW somewhere.
Oh, I'm sure there is. I know it's in the library.
So. Oh, it is. Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Let's turn now to medical genetics. When R.A. Brink wrote you a letter telling you about the Wisconsin job on July 19, 1947. Buried in page 2, he had the following sentence. Currently, the Department of Genetics has no work in progress cooperatively with the medical school, but I know of nothing in particular which would hinder such a development if it seemed desirable. Now, that turned out to be the case, but it took a few years. Talk about the development, the early development of the what became the Department of Medical Genetics at the university.
Well, to start with, my own work was in the genetics of microorganisms, and while I was very much concerned about the further reaches of genetics and its implications for medicine, that was not going to be a first-order consequence of my own investigations. Nevertheless, I was strongly committed to medicine and medically-oriented research. I had gone past the midway mark in my studies as a medical student. I had faced a very difficult dilemma about deciding whether to continue for my MD. And it would have been very much my preference to have continued my research work in a more medical environment. But I was accustomed to not doing that. After all, I had worked at Morningside Heights campus, not the medical school campus, and my work with Ryan at Columbia, and likewise at Yale, although I was a frequent visitor to the medical library and knew a lot of the folks in the medical school at Yale. My own laboratory was actually in the Department of Botany on the main campus of the university. So although it would have been a druther preference, it didn't seem like it was in the cards, and actually there was not that much interest in genetics on the part of medical schools generally. There was nothing going on at Columbia, for example, and
amazing.
I can't think of any genetics at Yale Medical School either, for that matter. Maybe I'm overlooking something, but if so, it was certainly not very prominent. But there were matters of locating genetic factors in the human, of genetic counseling, of assaying for tracing pedigrees. The field was burgeoning. A very important point. I'd gotten to know Jim Neal rather well. He had gotten a PhD, I think, with Kurt Stern, whose name will come up again, at Rochester. Had been a visitor at Columbia. Then made the very bold decision that he was going to go into human genetics and he was going to get an MD. And I remember many of us buzzing around that, around the department. He was some few years older than me, so I was on the fringes of the discussion, thinking it was really kind of crazy. What could you do in human genetics? You can't do experiments. You have to rely on population observation and so forth. But lo and behold, Jim persevered, and he proved famously that he was right. He worked out the genetics of sickle cell disease, that it was a mutation, a classic recessive mutation. In a way, he was, you might say, the intellectual heir to Archibald Garrod, who was a highly neglected figure in the history of medicine, but who had enunciated these basic principles of defective genes interfering with metabolic reactions, starting, believe it or not, back in 1901 or 1902. So he carried the ball on that in a really wonderful fashion. Well, that's part of the background of my thinking about how we're going to instill more genetics into medical research and into medical education. But in spite of what Alec Brink's saying, that there's no obstacle to this, neither was there much enthusiasm. There was no obvious niche for it. There was no receptor site. Van Potter and a few other folks around the cancer Research Center.
McArdle.
And the McArdle would have certainly listened to these matters. I had posited a genetic theory, the somatic mutation theory for the origin of cancer while I was a medical student in 1946, and we could have, whether we did or not, we certainly could have had many conversations around that. But nothing was happening, and I was really very, very busy with my own research, so I didn't fret too much about that kind of extension, although I would certainly have welcomed it if there were any opportunity. Well, the opportunity, the possibility of going further in that direction appeared with John Bauer's arrival as the dean of the medical school in 1955. It so happened I had met John in Berkeley in 1950 during my teaching sabbatical that summer, and I'd met him at a dinner at Kurt Stern's home. Kurt had moved from Rochester, I mentioned his name just a few moments ago, to being a professor of biology and genetics at Berkeley, and one of the most respected figures in the field, the editor of the journal Genetics, very much in touch with just every aspect of genetic research. He would have known Bowers from Bowers' connection with the Atomic Energy Commission for a few years. Prior to that time, he was the director of the Division of Biology and Medicine at the AEC, and in that position was overseeing research on effects of atomic radiation in animals, and also the program of investigation of the consequences of Hiroshima at the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission. And AEC had commissioned a number of studies on biological effects of atomic radiation, so that, by the way, Jim Crow had played a very active role in. So Kurt was a very familiar figure. I had known him since I'd been a student at Columbia in the early 40s from his visits. He was a Drosophila geneticist, and we did not interact more deeply otherwise. Well, John was about to assume his position as dean of the medical school at the University of Utah, and I challenged him at the dinner table about what he was going to do about genetics in his new role, and urged him to consider that carefully. And I got an encouraging kind of response. It was no, I don't know to what extent that had already been on his mind. It could not have been totally not there. I mean, with his background in research in radiobiology, he may have thought of it as subsidiary to radiobiology, and I would have given higher prominence to other more fundamental aspects of genetics as well. I don't recall if I'd had any further contact with John before his arrival to Madison, and certainly I played no role in the search or his selection. But as soon as I heard he was coming, I contacted him right away and repeated my challenge. I said, what about doing something here? And he said, let's try it. And I had very positive encouragement towards the further development of a program. So he asked me to put together proposals for it, what I would do about it and so forth, which I then did. And then this eventuated first in proposing a program which would involve the opportunity. I have to say the most important immediate thing was for teaching in the medical curriculum in order to have a stance.
Well, how was genetics handled in the medical program before?
It wasn't. It was non-existent.
Really? Did they take courses out of agriculture?
No, they did not teach genetics.
Oh my goodness.
No, that was typical. It's hard to believe today.
It's impossible to believe.
I'm sure if it would have been typical of most medical schools, and Wisconsin was not likely to be more advanced than others in this regard, that they would have a course in embryology and human development as a subsidiary to the gross anatomy course, and then within that framework that there would be two or three lectures on Mendelian genetics. Some might even have taught Garrod or a few of the other syndromes. I mean, there wasn't that much information to teach one has to understand. One needed a perspective that said that the human is an animal organism and that the rules of inheritance are going to be the same for humans as they are for other creatures, but it was not an institutionalized program.
Professor Lederberg just handed me a copy of Principles of Human Genetics, the second edition, compiled or written by Kurt Stern.
This is the Professor Stern that I was mentioning just a moment ago. Although 99% of Kurt's research was in Drosophila genetics, he was one of the very early people to study crossing over in Drosophila and the developmental impact of any number of different kinds of mutations and so on. He was a next generation after Muller, Morgan, Sturtevant. These studies, but he had a deep interest in human genetics. He taught it not in the medical school, but as a course in the biology curriculum at the University of California. And it was basically the only book available, and an excellent text as it was. Now, the history of the teaching of genetics in medical schools has yet to be written. It did exist as a subsidiary topic. I think the first major teaching program, and I don't think it was elevated to the level of the department, was Jim Neal when he went to the University of Michigan after he left Rochester. but even there, still had a secondary role in the teaching of medical students. And it would not have been unusual. I think the typical pattern, as I recall from my own experience as a student and what I heard elsewhere from others, would be that a few lectures in genetics, Mendelian ratios, segregative genes, what genes are, and so forth, would have been given as part of an embryology course. And then there would have been examples like hair color, and a few of the classical recessive mutations. One of the first of those to be well understood was sickle cell disease, a hemoglobin disorder, and the genetics of that was only first worked out by Jim Neal, I think in the middle or late 40s. This became the centerpiece of molecular genetics, and Pauling and Itano wrote a paper not long after Jim Neal's elucidation of the simple genetics behind it, that sickle cell hemoglobin was a chemical variant of normal hemoglobin, and eventually they and Singer were able to work out the structure that the alteration of a single amino acid in hemoglobin gave rise to the alteration, and that in turn to the clinical syndrome that we call sickle cell disease today. This is the beginning, one might say, of molecular genetics, that is to say, of the understanding of a disease syndrome of genetic origin in molecular terms. So the field was just beginning at a research level, but it was taught only quite incidentally in the schools. But there were questions of radiation injury, of chemical mutagenesis, than one had to be concerned about. I think one of the drawbacks, one of the things that held back the teaching of the subject in a medical context, was the cloud of eugenics, and that in turn the abuses of the Nazi regime. And that's something from which human genetics has had a great difficulty getting out from under really ever since.
Yeah.
There was a certain debate going on that Muller was one of the centerpieces about what extent one should encourage selectivity in human reproduction in ways analogous to how we breed racehorses or better strains of corn and so forth. And there are so many obvious ethical no-nos in that general arena, you can see how it might be regarded as a very touchy subject. But at any rate, I don't recall ever having been invited to lecture to the medical students. There wouldn't have been a place for it. There wouldn't have been time for it in the curriculum during my earlier days at Wisconsin. So I did propose the establishment of what was first a program and then a Department of Genetics to try to instill better appreciation of the wonderful developments that were coming along. I mean, for gosh sakes, remember we had the structure of DNA worked mm-hmm. out in 1953, mm-hmm. and you know, anyone with any sense whatsoever could have foreseen, and many of us did foresee, that this was going to overtake many aspects of research in medicine, as it was already beginning to in agriculture. I had plenty of encouragement from John. This went to the point of wanting to build a little small sub-department or department. Newton Morton was a recent graduate from Jim Crow, very skilled in population genetics, who had been a very good starting point for a human genetics program. I would have brought my own microbiological side to bear. There would have been others with a more molecular orientation. Now, the question of name is an interesting feature. Because there already was a genetics department, mm-hmm. It would have been confusing to have a department of genetics in the medical school. So the word medical was put on there with some misgivings on my part, because my view was a basic science department, mm. but centered in a medical school. But that was a convenience to put yeah. medical in front of it. I thought it would be too confining a term, because it would not have left place for me, no. For example, or for the more molecular aspects of it. And for somewhat similar reasons, human genetics. There were human genetics programs, but that was only a small part, in my view, of what genetics was going to have to offer.
Yeah, it was originally called the program field. In human genetics, I believe. Yeah.
But again, for similar reasons, an unqualified genetics would have been confusing mm-hmm. in relating it to the existing department in the College of Agriculture. Best of all is what eventually happened, and that was a unification of these programs, making it a cross-school initiative. I don't really know any other good way to solve that problem. You cannot, for the last 30 years, not have genetics in agriculture, and you could not have it in medicine, and there is so much that is shared between them in a common basic foundation that some means of coordination is absolutely necessary. Well, when John Bowers was getting started on this, we in a sense didn't know how to do it. There was no easy framework for establishing these new kinds of relationships, and had to face a lot of conservatism on the part of the existing faculty in the School of mm-hmm. Medicine, not a lot of enthusiasm on the ag side either. I mean, there were all kinds of turf issues and a lot of split votes on many of the committees, although there was a slow but eventual approval of these concepts as it worked its way through the medical school and the rest of the university administration. There was a question of funding, and although there was reasonable promise of substantial support from the Rockefeller Foundation, they were not going to provide endowment in perpetuity, and one of our repeated arguments was, even if we could get the funds for a five-year program, where was the guarantee of funding after that point? Now, I think if the powers that be could have had more foresight about which way the field was going and how indispensable it was going to be, they would have understood that willy-nilly that was something that had to be furthered. But that was...
Now, the powers that be, are you talking about the university administration?
Top levels of administration, the people who have to eventually take mm-hmm. the gambles mm-hmm. of where they're mm-hmm. going to commit hard money for long-term programs. So understandably, that was rather grudging, and I don't know what all the other pressures were. There are always many other things, good things to be done with a given set of resources. But it was pretty slow going, getting that degree of formal approval, even with the promise of short-term funding from outside sources. So this kind of dragged on through 56, 57. Barry, you've got the chronicle
of
the exact dates.
And this will be in your folders in the Oral History Project, so people can...
That would be good, and I'll go over that carefully and add whatever correction I can. Mm-hmm. Off the top of my head, I couldn't recite the specific dates or each of the stages that was involved. And I'm trying now to convey the spirit with which this was happening. John showed a lot of dynamism, maybe too much so, maybe tried to push things through faster than the medical community was ready to accept it. I had certainly friends there, not a great many of them, but people like Phil Cohen were certainly mm-hmm. enthusiastic about it, and Van Potter. The microbiologists, I think, were mostly uncomprehending. I think Paul Clark probably had some positive vision in this direction, but he had long since retired as chair. Mm-hmm. I don't know where else I would have seen a base. I'll have to check who the professor of anatomy was. He would have had to have played some role in this regard, since it was near his turf mm-hmm. that this would be operating. And meantime, other things were happening in my life and my ambitions and aspirations, and I'm sure that they were connected with some degree of exasperation that mm-hmm. things didn't happen promptly, enthusiastically, that it took all the push that Bowers and myself could offer to have them move at all. As far as other members of the genetics department were concerned, I'm sure Jim was very enthusiastic.
Jim Crow,
he himself would, in any circumstance, have played a major part in it. His own research was starting to turn towards human genetics as well. And as events later turned out, he inherited these problems of coordination of the medical mm-hmm. school department with the ag school. I think Brink and Irwin may have been a little perturbed that I was so distracted by organizational issues. They may have felt quite rightly that this was going to compete in time and energy with my own basic research. I think at heart their druther might have been that I would have stuck to just doing pure lab work, but they also understood the realities of what was happening to genetics in the wider world. So they certainly gave plenty of support. I think as much in order to be on my behalf, because it was something that I wanted to do, as their own conviction that it was doable. But at any rate, I didn't lack for a sympathetic base, but they were not providing aggressive energy for it. And I think they may have well foreseen that there would be a lot of problems getting it to happen. There was less than enthusiasm on the part of many other members of the genetics department. They weren't going to get in the way, but they weren't going to push it either. And I think there are minutes that reflect split mm-hmm. votes
right.
on a number
six,
of the
steps like
that might confound the boundaries of genetics with the rest of the world and so on. I suppose there was always the potential of competition for resources that but I think there was less than great vision about how, even at the funding level, how there would be no lack of funding in those days. And this proved to be the case at Stanford. If you had an imaginative program, you'd end up not with competition, but with a great amplification of resources.
Mm. There's also, go ahead. There's also the fact that you were looking at looking to hire other people in the new Department of Genetics. We're talking specifically about Hershey, Atwood, and Novick.
Well, it was a question of what a department could do and how it could all be brought together. And my own area was focused on microbiology. I thought it needed a little more biochemistry. It needed a human touch as well. It might well have had, could have thought about people working in mouse genetics as being more connected with it, although I didn't have an immediate candidate in that direction. So Newton was the first option. The next was Kimball Atwood, who was at that time doing some very interesting studies in mutagenesis in the human using red cell phenotypes as a measure. He found ways in which one could measure the frequency of oddball erythrocytes that had a different antigenic composition from the main population, and attempted to validate that as a measure of mutations occurring during the production of red cells. He published a number of papers on that, and I think that's been regarded as a very useful tool. And he would then want to correlate it with exposure to radiation, exposure to chemicals, and so on. That would be an in situ test of mutations occurring in somatic cells in the human. So he had a solid base for that research, and he was someone I had had a very close personal history with. In fact, he and I had roomed together in New York when we were both medical school students. He went to NYU and I went to Columbia. At some point in this arrangement, he married, and Barbie moved in with us. It was not, it wasn't easy to find a place to live. Well, there's nothing lonelier than being the third man in, a in an arrangement like that. And so I did find other quarters after a few months. I just saw Barbie. Kim died about 2 years ago. He had retired and were living at Woods Hole, and I was reminiscing about this with her at Woods Hole. At any rate, Kim had done brilliant work in a number of different areas and was eager to have him as a member of the department. He was not notable for reliability in answering his mail, providing manuscripts in time and so forth, and that came to the fore here as well. In connection with the launching of the new department, Bowers suggested that we have, but at any rate, between the two of us, we agreed to organize a symposium that might help define the field of genetics in a medical context. Again, it seems absurd that one would have to do it, but this did not exist at that time. And, so this was scheduled for April
7th through 10th, 1958.
Right. And Kim, among many others, we had quite a few notables organized to appear at this symposium. Kim did come, gave a paper, but in the final event never turned in a manuscript, so it's been published without his contribution in it. Well, that's the way it was. There was considerable discussion about Atwood's appointment, and there was a decision to postpone a decision until after the symposium and see what kind of impression he made. But other events overtook the process before that materialized. In other words, I made a decision to leave Wisconsin, and that put the question of any other appointments on hold, obviously. And
did you decide to leave before the symposium?
No, I think my letter to Elvium was in May 1958. It was very close on. I was in continued negotiations, actually starting with the December 1956, I believe, is when Tatum announced his moving to the Rockefeller University. It's funny how we chased each other around.
Yes, you certainly did.
From Stanford. Left a vacancy at Stanford. I was visiting in California at that time and had some discussion with Stanford officials about the possibility of my being considered for professorship to succeed Tatum in that role. I very promptly made inquiry about what possibilities of my connections with the medical school might be and got a pretty negative response. There were plans afoot to establish a new school on the main campus, moving the Stanford Medical School, which was associated with a hospital in San Francisco, to the Palo Alto campus, and this was to be a major burgeoning science-based school, very close interconnections with the rest of the campus and so on. And it would have been a delight to hear that it was going to embrace genetics as well. But the dean at the time had no interest in it, really gave me no encouragement. Said, well, we'll be happy to have you teach some of our courses if you're established over in the biology department. That was pretty much of a sine qua non for me for any move that I was going to make. It's not as if Stanford at that time was really such a power base in science or in biology. It was just at the beginning of its renaissance under Fred Terman's administration. Tatum was no longer there, Beadle had left. I didn't know what else might be going on in biology to make it attractive. And so while it was in a very nice geographical setting, Berkeley seemed a much more exciting place. Mm-hmm. Well, as soon as word got to Berkeley that I'd been talking to Stanford, I started hearing from them about whether I would consider the possibility of an appointment there. And so early in 1957, started conversations with, there was a genetics department at mm-hmm. Berkeley, but it was in the School of H&S, although this was just at the time that they were beginning to organize the UC Davis campus, a new school in the California system, and possibility of moving the genetics department to Davis. That did not appeal to me. It didn't mm-hmm. appeal to a number of the existing members of genetics.
I'll bet.
Curiously, Kurt Stern was in the biology department, not the genetics department. It had to do with ag school connections and so on and so forth. But at any rate, things did move very substantially for a position at Berkeley. And while Berkeley did not have a medical school, it did have a school of public health and was at least loosely affiliated with the medical school in San Francisco. And while there was nothing very solidly laid down, there was a very rich intellectual environment at Berkeley, even without a medical school. So I was very seriously mm-hmm. contemplating that. As that was proceeding on its own course, the summer of 57, I was away for many months mm-hmm. In my sabbatical at Melbourne, so picked up the threads again in late 1957, and it began to look more and more attractive. There were a lot of issues.
Yeah, I mean Berkeley.
Berkeley.
Yeah.
There were a lot of issues about laboratory space, but that was satisfactorily resolved. A position for my wife Esther, again, resolved. There were, as with other state schools, problems about nepotism of having two people from the same family in the same department that had to be worked through. But that looked as if it was going quite smoothly. And I, coupled with my exasperation about how things were not moving all that well at Madison, and a certain restlessness after a while that I enjoyed the somewhat bucolic atmosphere of Madison as a relief from a very hectic, frenzied childhood in New York City. Mm-hmm. Being near San Francisco and the still broader life of Berkeley, I'd had a brief experience of it in 50, and while I didn't have as many close personal friends there as I did in Madison, I had many people that I had very high regard for, and thought it might be a reasonable thing to do. Mm-hmm. So, that was dashed rather suddenly when, in spite of having been approved at every stage of the game on the Berkeley campus, I got an astonishing letter from Jenkins, who was the head of the genetics department, very embarrassed, but saying they were not able to proceed and that the president of the Cal system had vetoed it, and with essentially no explanation of the reasons for it. But meanwhile, more had been happening at Stanford. And although I had been in effect rebuffed of even bringing the subject up in the first round, the acting dean was replaced. Bob Olway, who was head of pediatrics, came in to oversee the building of the school and its move from San Francisco. Bob was a pediatrician, and while he himself had not been in genetics, pediatricians of any branch of medicine are the ones most closely affiliated with human genetic study for obvious reasons. Most of the genetic syndromes we're concerned about are appear in newborn and in very young children, and so they're a much more natural part of the repertoire of their thinking than most other aspects of medicine. Well, not only was he sympathetic to the idea, they were just about to recruit Kornberg, and they were then thinking of a package deal. If Kornberg were recruited, would I come? and I didn't need a lot of arm twisting on that score. One of the things I was sorely lacking at Wisconsin was a base of interest, knowledge, ongoing programs in nucleic acid chemistry. And of course, Kornberg was absolutely the top of the pack. He was just crystallizing his studies on the DNA polymerase, the very enzymes that are involved in DNA replication, and so on. I'd met him a couple of times before then, knew we'd get along very well. Anyhow, he was very enthusiastic about the idea, too. But I felt committed to Berkeley. I didn't feel I could explore this very much more fully, having signed my half of the contract. And then lo and behold, in one sense, the rug was pulled out from under me, but I said, hallelujah. that eventuated in pretty short order, I think, within 2 months of the time I had a no from Berkeley. I had a firm yes from Stanford. Decided to do it, and then wrote a letter to President Elvium indicating this, and you have this letter in your file.
Did UW know that this was going on at the time, and did they do anything at all to try to alter your...
I didn't push very hard. I didn't make it a secret, nor would it have been possible to, since there were a lot of letters going around asking about me and so forth. But I was not getting into a bargaining game.
Well, it's not even as much a bargaining as did UW try to get you to stay?
I think they felt they'd already done all that they could in my previous gambits, and I did not have a firm promise of the additional positions that I was asking for. I was not unable to make an offer to Atwood, and I'm sure that if I had really wanted to stay at Wisconsin, I could have parlayed this into pushing that process. But I was not about to play any games. Once I had decided where my preferences were going to lie, I then presented my conclusions. I didn't want to get into a bargaining game of any kind.
Now, in going back a little bit, I know that in 1950, I believe, the University of Chicago made an offer to you, or pursued you. Did they make an offer, actually?
Yes. I'd had very close relationships with Novick and Szilard. They were building up a biophysics unit at the University of Chicago and inquired about my interest. And it, I did not give it... gross encouragement, but I didn't need to. I mean, they really pressed the matter fairly hard. While there were many aspects of the University of Chicago that were very appealing, it had a very rich intellectual life. There was there was more going on in the areas of my immediate interest in a way than in Madison. But we had moved there, you know, just in the last 2 or 3 years. We'd been greeted very warmly, had been treated very well, I just didn't see moving at that stage. And so I was grateful for the offer, but I felt happy to stay where I was at the time.
I know the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia made you a job offer as well. Was that a little after Chicago?
Yeah, I think around 55, there were two other things like it. I gave some lectures in Denver, and Ted Puck then started to move to see about some genetics program in their medical school.
Really? I didn't know that.
And so we had some conversation about that. That's where I first met Bob Glazer, who ended up later on as dean of the Stanford Medical School. He was on the faculty there at the time. There was a Dr. Michael John, who was head of medicine, who was the principal conversant. What was appealing, and this is largely Ted's interest, he was one of the founders of somatic cell genetics, putting human cells into tissue culture and doing genetic experiments with those cultures. So there was something to resonate with there as well. The issue of facilities was probably the thing that would most drive my exploring some other opportunities, they were really very primitive and remain so, pretty much, although I had one renovation, it was it was hampering,
no question about it.
And then, in somewhat similar vein, Hiller Koprowski, who was reorganizing the Wistar Institute at the University of Pennsylvania, made a similar bid around that period of time and offered a lot in terms of facilities and, again, a very interesting immediate intellectual environment. So I could see things moving at other institutions, and they seem to be kind of stuck. Mm-hmm. I mean, my appointment was a very happy one, but it wasn't obvious was going to go any further than that in the area of my main interest. Nevertheless, it was Stanford that was.
So nevertheless, in the end, Stanford came out with the on top of.
Well, it had everything going for it. I mean, first of all, to be really wanted, and I don't mean in a superficial way of a star and a flag, but a real understanding of the program that I wanted to develop, that it interdigitated with the ideals of the school, a very progressive attitude, spirit of growth, and was not just going to be me and my group, other things are going to be burgeoning as well. An attitude about medical education, that it was to be, education itself was to be very research-oriented, a very strong scientific base. And at the same time, the interdisciplinary connections with the rest of the school. And it sank into me that while things were moving slowly, they were in fact moving in every other department. And Fred Terman had shown very great leadership in as the provost in building the school and its science base, parlaying the leverage from federal funding in every way imaginable. And so this combination that the climate draws the people, draws the money, you know, makes the community, a lot of mutual reinforcement of all the assets. And of course, it was the rebuilding of Stanford University. Mm-hmm. We're right in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. It was the beginning of Silicon Valley and the not too many years after that of Biotechnology Alley in terms of being at the very focus of some of the most exciting developments in every field.
That would be exciting. Did everything come to bear out at Stanford? Let's just jump ahead. We're going to come back to you leaving Wisconsin in a little bit, but did things work out as you had hoped when you went out there?
Oh, in many ways exceeded my expectations, especially the interdisciplinary base, and I ended up having a wonderful opportunity to spread my wings from everything from computer science to international security and arms control, and founding a human biology curriculum. And the computer science-based research, artificial intelligence, the Dendrol Project, the instrumentation laboratory. I'm pointing to all the interdisciplinary programs that could have happened nowhere else. Oddly enough, my main disappointment about Stanford was in the medical school. While it built an extraordinary basic science division, and people like Arthur Kornberg, above all, just no match anywhere, the interdigitation of the basic science with the clinical programs was more disappointing. Wisconsin had never aspired to that, so I won't use that as a comparison, but I'd say, compared, say, to UC San Francisco, I think Stanford really fell well behind on that particular axis.
What do you attribute that to?
It's a little hard to say. It'll end up being personalities. At Stanford, the sheer financial flow and power of the clinical programs ended up dominating the direction of the school. While there was certainly a very high quality of research in those programs, it's not bad compared to any other place in the country, it didn't really match the full aspirations of what had been looked for earlier in the ideals of the school. And this is a problem that will beset many, many academic medical centers, and that as the funding base for the continued operation of the school chases the patients, chases the dollars, provides a political base for the continued development of the organization, the basic science in its connections with the clinical programs tends to lose out. Now, you know, why should we complain? The basic science component did benefit in addition to what by contemporary standards will seem like unlimited amounts of federal funding. This is the burgeoning years of the NIH and so forth. There was probably some spillover of certainly in the overhead accounts of income from clinical activity that it's hard to be sure of the accounting, but there's probably the net balance that did favor the basic science departments as well. So that part there's no complaint about. It's the integration of it with clinical activity that I think did fall behind, or at least did not meet my expectations.
Okay, let's take a little break here. And okay, you had the Berkeley job pulled out from under you in May of 58. On July 19th of 1958, you wrote President Elvium saying that you were going to leave UW for a job at Stanford. A few months later, you were notified that you won the Nobel Prize. That was in October of 1958. Could you talk about a little bit about that rather, I'm sure, hectic period in your life?
Well, hectic is writing it in small. You can well imagine that we were totally preoccupied with preparing our move, having everything involved in that, from selling our house to making provision for where we're going to live at Stanford, thinking about organizing a laboratory there, everything that goes along with that, as well as preparing our goodbyes for our dear friends in Madison. So it was really quite a shock in many ways to have this additional turbulence when I was telephoned by a newspaper reporter, and again you've got the exact dates down in the chronology, wanting to know my reactions to having been awarded the Nobel Prize. I said, ha ha ha, what kind of a joke is that? And he tried to reassure me that it was authentic, and I said, why should I believe so? I thought somebody was pulling a practical joke on me. I had no expectation that I was being considered for the prize. And it was a standoff with the reporter, but I thought this was going to generate a very difficult situation. If the rumor of this were to be spread any further, and if I meet my friends who then would be effulgent in their congratulations, how was I going to deal with them the next day later on when they discovered it was all a joke? And I wanted to spare them and myself the embarrassment of that event. I was quite serious about that. So I did confide in one of my friends and went into hiding for the next 24 hours until it was a clear understanding of what was actually happening. This was awkward. I mean, it was painful enough, severing the bonds. How do you justify to your friends that you're leaving to go someplace else? It was certainly not going away mad, and least of all to my close friends within the Department of Genetics per se, and you know, people like Alec Brink and Bob Irwin and Jim, and they had done so many things for me and had worked so hard to make it possible for me to be there in the first place. Well, they took it with much better grace than I might have expected. I could almost have imagined being scolded for having turned my back on them. But, so I scolded myself, and maybe they thought that might be sufficient, so they could not have been more gracious about all of it. And then to have the prize come in just at that point was, for many people, sort of bittersweet, because while for almost any institution, having one of its people awarded the prize is a matter of great thrill and benefits the institution in so many different ways. Exactly the opposite is true if it's someone who's already on the point of leaving, that it magnifies the rebuff that's entailed by the departure. So I felt very embarrassed and very awkward about that. But you know, that couldn't be helped. I even wondered about not accepting the prize.
Did you really?
Oh, yes, very seriously. I had commented to other people, including some friends in Sweden, about what all this fuss about the prizes. Was it really that helpful to science? Did it elicit inappropriate competitiveness in some areas and so forth? And in any case, there was a certain complication about trying to find awardees, that so much scientific work is so closely interwoven with that of others that you're bound to leave people out when you make an award. Was it worth it? Anyhow, there were a lot of reasons why that was not a feasible approach. I was ambivalent, but you know, not decided. There were virtues to getting the prize, some obvious, some not so obvious. But at an even deeper level, to have turned it down would have been a slap in the face of Ed Tatum, who was a co-prize winner, and couldn't imagine his rejecting it. Besides, it would have resulted in even more notoriety.
Yeah, right. Then you would have been the headlines in every paper.
And, you know, that was exactly what I was inveighing against. So I decided to endure it, enjoy it, get what profit there was, which was enormous from it. So I just mention it as a trivial reflection, but one I was giving some thought to. But that was aggravated by the immediate circumstance of the prize being awarded just as I was leaving one place and going to another. It left the pleasure in it in limbo. It was bittersweet at Wisconsin, yet at the same time it deprived Stanford. They couldn't really own the prize. If it had happened 2 years later, they would have boasted a Stanford faculty person gets the prize. And that even had a little bitter taste in the following way, that so many people got confused and said, oh, Stanford went after prize winners, that it was the éclat of the award that motivated Stanford to make the offer to me in the first place. So that may not seem like a large point, but there's more to Josh Lederberg than that he's a Nobel Prize winner. So for all those reasons, this was complicated. For a while, my wife Esther was so busy and so preoccupied about moving that she was seriously thinking about not making the trip. That was a week, 10 days out of a very short period of time for overall preparations, but she was persuaded that it would be better to do so. So it was a very busy time between in August and November. On the one hand, preparing for the Swedish trip, on the other hand, packing up and preparing to move. So yes, it was very hectic. What I did find was an acceptable route to deferring my lecture, because to do a good job in preparing the categorical Nobel lecture was, I think, almost impossible under those circumstances. So, in fact, I read the statutes and found that they say that the lecture can be given any time within 6 months of the award. So I contracted to do that right off the bat, and was relieved of having to make that preparation under those very hectic circumstances.
Yeah, you gave a talk called The View of Genetics, and I think it was just about 6 months after you...
Well, that was calculated.
Yeah. I was wondering why there was that long time period. That answers it.
So that gave me time to settle in at Stanford and have a little bit of time to actually prepare the presentation.
What about the ceremony itself? What was it like? What was your participation?
It was a whole week of festivities. We were greeted at the airplane. We had a kind of an honor guard. We had escorts assigned to us from the old Swedish nobility. I've gotten to know indirectly, by a very different route, I should say, a man who we got to know because he was a tenant in our home at Stanford, but he ends up, he's the Secretary General of what's called the House of Nobles, which is the remaining institution of the nobility in Sweden. That's a carryover from many, many years past. But they do try to maintain both a constructive and a ceremonial linkage to their old aristocratic traditions. Anyhow, this is the cadre of people who were assigned as escorts for us for our entire stay. The whole country is involved in Nobel Week. It's a week of celebration, and they can use a little encouragement in midwinter.
Yeah.
if the lights aren't on, it's pitch darkness at almost any time of day. So, so there were banquets and affairs of that kind almost nonstop for the entire week.
Did you have to give any short talks, or were you introduced to crowds? How did that work?
There were several such occasions. The faculties of the universities, there were presentations. Some of the all the other Nobelists gave their formal talks during that week,
during
and we'd be in attendance for those presentations as well. Then, besides the academic meetings, there was the formal ceremony in this very beautiful structure of the town hall, wonderfully decorated, but a beautiful stone building in its own right. And ceremonial like you couldn't believe.
Yeah,
and
that's great.
It's actually been recounted in some detail by others who took notes minute by minute by what went on, so I don't think I'll add much to the historical record. There's a chapter in a book by Jerry Weissman that's just coming out that is devoted entirely to this. He was an observer at such an event. But there's a formal presentation. The king actually makes the award. You're in formal attire, which means white tie. Goes without saying in Sweden when you say that. Tuxedo, black tie is called a smoking.
I wouldn't know.
The protocol and the ritual that's involved there, we were indoctrinated about that, and probably no less than half a dozen different press conferences of reactions and statements and so on. Some conversation among the laureates. I was very glad to meet a Russian physicist called Igor Tom, who was together with Cherenkov and Frank, were the physicists who were the Nobel laureates that year, but he was by far the most open in his language. He was obviously a very liberal-minded person. He told me he was old enough, he didn't worry too much about whether he would be punished for being outspoken. But this was also the year that Boris Pasternak was the prize winner in literature and was not allowed to come. And there was a very impassioned speech, I think by Tezelius, but one of the Swedish presenters at the formal ceremony, analogizing this to the ban on Galileo and the inhibitions on scholarship that the Soviet regime represented. So that must have been a little bit awkward for the Russian physicists at that time, but I think, if anything, Igor Tom congratulated it. The others kept their mouth shut. Sanger was there for one of his numerous Nobel Prize appearances.
I didn't know he won numerous.
Well, another one since then, anyhow. For his work on the working out the amino acid sequence of insulin. There was Beadle and Tatum were my co-laureates. Now, there's a little technicality there that someplace ought to be on the record. The prize was divided into two parts. I received one part, and then Beadle and Tatum shared the other part. So they were making a delineation. The Beadle and Tatum award was for their joint work on Neurospora, and while Tatum had been my collaborator, this was an acknowledgement of the fact that the work really had been done at my own initiative, and I had done 95% of the laboratory work, and while I owe a great deal to Ed for having provided the facilities and the overall background, that it was their recognition that this had been my own project. I think that's fully substantiated in the other record that you have. It's not a point that I want to make any fuss about, and that the three of us shared the prize is a perfectly sufficient statement. I was very proud, very honored to have been in their company. I mean, these are people who had preceded me by 10 or 15 years in their own scientific development, and I had stood on their shoulders for the work that I had done, which was still a further leap in extending to bacteria the opportunity of doing molecular genetic experimentation that they had pioneered in Neurospora. Now, I had never doubted that they would eventually receive the Nobel Prize. I never thought that that issue would come around to me. I was only 33 at that time.
Yeah, that's one I was just going to say. You were very young at that point.
And I'd done the work when I was 21. So I thought prizes came to graybeards. Historically, that's not always been true, but it was certainly not in my mind at any point. It was an utter shock and utter surprise when it
You really, came truly did not expect to win, or it hadn't crossed your mind that at that point in time that...
I thought that if I were a good enough scientist and continued along the path I had, that in another 20 years maybe I'd have an accumulated body of work that would qualify for it. But basically, I just wasn't giving it very much thought, and just that.
In your talks to the press and whatnot, immediately after being named to the award, you did make a point of naming several other people who had been important in your career and who had helped you. And in your Madison press conference, you might have named related it to people mainly from Madison, but you gave eight names of people who you said were very helpful in your career, in your pursuit of the prize, or in your winning of the prize, excuse me. And the names you mentioned were Bradley, Covelli, Phil Edwards, Morris, Stocker, Wright, and Zinder and
Eno.
You've talked about all of those.
Yeah, well, they were the people closely associated with my laboratory as of that time.
Who's Phil Edwards? You didn't mention him.
Phil Edwards was, I mentioned getting enormous help from the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta.
Was that him?
He was the leader of that group, provided the raw material with which we did the studies on the immunogenetics of Salmonella. And we had visited him for a couple of weeks in 1953 in order to continue that work. So couldn't possibly have done the Salmonella immunological studies without all the reagents he provided. He provided all the raw material for it.
How helpful was the Nobel Prize to you subsequently, to your career after that?
I know it's a mixed bag. I didn't need it. I mean, my career was going just fine. I was receiving lots of recognition here. I had already been appointed to my Stanford post. It probably added a little bit to prestige that I could garner in my further dealings at Stanford. Probably helped Stanford in their fundraising to be able to support the work that I was going to do. I have no doubt that it would do that. So it had those material benefits. I was already pretty notorious in the field I had pioneered in, so I was not an obscure personality, picked out of the air that was suddenly made famous by the prize. Now, maybe in the popular press there would have been a different view of it, but I wasn't too concerned about that. It probably gave me a standing outside of the immediate scientific area that I would not have had otherwise. There's a kind of certification of authority that goes mm-hmm. along with it. If a Nobel Prize winner in public talks about a scientific topic, sometimes quite inappropriately, it's credited with being likely to be true.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that has been abused in so many ways, especially since that time, that probably doesn't count for that much anymore. But, you know, when Bill Shockley, who had gotten a Nobel Prize in physics, went off on his rant about racial differences in intelligence mm-hmm. and things mm-hmm. of that sort, that's the flip side mm-hmm. of this kind of authority, and it made it all the more vital that I respond to the kinds of things he was saying, because he had that seeming cloak of authority. It probably drew attention to me in policy quarters so that I would be consulted drawn upon for things that they might not otherwise mm-hmm. have heard about me. It's a weight of responsibility not to abuse the confidence that is still attached to that dignity. So the way I generally put it is that I don't think the Nobel Prize does much for individual scientists. If it goes to the right people, they don't need it. If it goes mm-hmm. to the wrong people, it's inappropriate. The cash has gotten to be a significant factor. It's worth, the prize now is worth over $1 million.
Mm.
My share of the prize in 58, now, you know, take inflation into account and so on, was $21,000. So while, yes, it was invested and it did grow, nothing like the dimensions
to
what the prize is these days. So the material aspects of it have altered very substantially. So it does draw more public attention, and at a certain level of the lay public, I really have to wince that I will always be introduced. Here's Josh Lederberg, the Nobel Prize winner, and that's an impediment. I have to work to get around it. What do you know about Josh Lederberg you didn't know before when you hear that he won a Nobel Prize? Well, if you knew he's a professor at Stanford and been a professor at Rockefeller, that's enough by way of authentication of credentials and so on. So in that sense, it's a source of distancing from people. It's dehumanizing in that regard.
Interesting perspective. Okay, you're gone now. You're at Stanford, beginning your new career, but you still maintained relations, of course, with your friends in Madison,
mm-hmm.
but you also returned to Madison on occasion. Could you discuss your continued relationship with
Madison?
Well,
I did from time to time. I haven't been back as often as I'd like, and I do miss the friends that that I don't see, not having that opportunity. You in conversation mentioned Harry Weissman. He was a pediatrician whom I'd gotten to know pretty well, and who's a renowned figure in the history of medical pediatrics at Wisconsin. He was quite interested in genetic disease. I think he played an important role in the development of PKU screening for newborns in Wisconsin, a number of related matters. I consulted with him. We may have been fellow members of a president's panel on mental retardation that President Kennedy's family had initiated quite early in President Kennedy's administration. So that was one tie-in. I was very happy to be asked to receive an honorary degree in 1967.
Mm-hmm.
I have an interesting story about how I got to Madison. It was to have been at the tail end of a trip where I was visiting the University of Pavia near Milan,
mm-hmm.
and then to go on from there to visit my parents in Tel Aviv in Israel. And then after a few days back to the States and back to Madison. Well, it didn't quite work out that way. When I left Milan, I checked my bags through in Alitalia on through Tel Aviv, but the travel agency had neglected to tell me that it was a different terminal in Rome for the connection, and I missed my flight. My bag went on to Tel Aviv, and here I was. Well, it just so happens that was the beginning of the Six-Day War, and the flight I did not get on was the last commercial flight into Israel at that time. So I was quite concerned about my parents.
Yes, of course.
I did call them, and didn't seem to be much that could be done, and there was nothing more I could do. So I ended up sans luggage back to the States. Had a day or two before it was due in Madison, so I joined my brother in Providence on the way back, managed to get a new suit of clothes in time for it, and did finally appear for the degree, which was in the football stadium.
Yes, where they still hold them. No, we have a new indoor facility now.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it. And my interviews by giving the person I'm interviewing the last word. Do you have any closing comments you would like to make about your career at the University of Wisconsin?
It was a wonderful experience for me. It was a different world. The university's roots had been in agriculture. There's a lifestyle, a closeness to the earth. Very important set of values that are connected with that, which I was glad to have an opportunity to experience. There was also a wonderful liberal tradition, a very tolerant one, that Wisconsin had been famous for. Of course, there was a severe blot on it with the Joe McCarthy days, but I think totally repudiated by the state as well. The university was the jewel of the state, was really regarded as such. The legislature was proud of it. And it's always been amazing that the state of Wisconsin, which I think ranks 24th in income by almost any other measure you care to measure among the states, population size and so forth, has still had one of the highest ranking of the public institutions of learning in the country, and I think that tradition has been maintained. The quality of friendships that we had, not only the very close and very intimate ones, but almost everybody else, I feel that whenever I come back to Madison, that you can count on an amiability and a friendliness and a courtesy that's really very, very hard to find anywhere else in the country at this time. Now, Madison has become heavily urbanized since 50 years ago and become probably more like the rest of the country in many regards, but I think it still has an edge on these kinds of qualities. It's a somewhat quieter life than, say, New York or San Francisco, but still has no lack of cultural amenities. You just don't have 20 or 30 to choose and pick amongst if you're talking about theater or music. But what there is very good, and if you don't have to work hard to have the advantage of it. The climate will leave to another situation. But it's the people that really are so wonderful. It's the people who are drawn there, the people that's, who stay there, the people whose own ethos is conditioned by the environment that they find and who then in turn condition that environment themselves. So I have just enormous fondness and admiration for every level of life there. I certainly learned a lot, grew a lot in the human as well as the professional side of my life, and would have been very sad indeed if I'd never been there.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your hospitality on my two trips to New York. I have thoroughly enjoyed meeting you and having these hours with you.